Luciano. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Welcome to this episode of A Lifestyle Pirates, number 66, with me, Big J, and him, Adriano.
Hola.
This episode, we are joined by a very, very interesting and cool, cool cat, a self-proclaimed narcissistic egomaniac, Mr. Peter Larvak. Pete, welcome to Lifestyle Pirates, buddy.
Good morning, guys. Welcome. Thank you for welcoming me.
Not a problem, awesome, mate. How are we doing?
Doing fantastic.
You've had I was doing a bit of research, as we do on our guests, mate. You've been a criminal lawyer for over 35 years.
46.
There you go. Yeah. So you need to update your wiki page.
Yes.
mate, you've beaten lung cancer.
Yes, 2008. I joined the 2% club.
Yeah,
nice.
Most people who had what I had are dead within 6 months.
Yeah.
15 years down the track, I'm still here.
Yeah.
Surviving and thriving.
Mate, love it. Love it. You're a surf ski champ. You're surf life-saving. You worked in Hong Kong for over 18 years.
Yes.
What else have we got? You're a movie star, which we'll definitely come back to. You've just launched a podcast.
Yes.
And you're a race car driver.
Correct.
I mean, mate, there's not much other boxes you can tick, is there?
All of the above, yes. I don't know if you got information, but I've also saved a judge's life in court. He was attacked by a crazed prisoner. And I disarmed a gunman at the Sydney Hilton when I was working there as a nightclub bouncer.
Mate, there's a lot to unpack here.
You've probably missed those two.
There's a few bits. One thing I've learned from you, mate, so we actually met, Pete and I met a few weeks ago now at the Bull Rush Rally, so 2022, for those of you that might be listening to this at a later date. Mate, you turned up in what I would call a weapon of mass destruction, your Lamborghini, hence you're known as the Lamborghini lawyer.
The Lambo lawyer.
Lawyer.
Yes, for obvious reasons, I drive a Lamborghini and I'm a lawyer.
Yeah, it's easy maths, mate.
It's creative.
How did you come to own one of the bulls, as it were?
The Lamborghini?
Mm.
Okay, I used to race a Ferrari when I was working in Hong Kong for 18 years, and that was a great car at the time. It was a 328 GTS. The Magnum PI car.
Nice.
Very attractive, nice to look at, good fun to drive, but it had its limitations. And when I left Hong Kong in 2003, I brought it back with me to Australia. And it's considerably underpowered, it's not as quick, and it's only a two-wheel drive. So I switched to a Lamborghini. I wanted to get back into car racing, so that's why I've got the Lamborghini now.
Nice. And why the Huracan?
Okay, I had been looking for an Aventador for several years, and I got a good mate named Ross Pendergast. He's also a race car driver. He's also a dealer in these cars, and we've been mates for a while, and I was on his back to find me an Aventador. I wanted a removable roof, the Spider, but they're pretty rare. He had a lot of trouble. He couldn't get one. So one day, purely on spec, I went to his showroom, and there, lo and behold, was a beautiful yellow and black Aventador, and parked immediately behind it was a yellow and black Hurricane. And I thought, wow, that's a nice car. So we started talking, and the rest is history.
Brilliant.
Nice.
Were there any qualifiers for you to buy the Hurricane?
Yes. I said to Ross, look, mate, the only deal breaker here would be if it doesn't get up my drive in Manly and if it doesn't fit into my garage. So he drove it down to Manly, and luckily it ticked both those boxes. So brilliant. I bought it on the spot for cash.
Love it, mate. Love
easy.
It. Now, we just did a bit of a fact check, didn't we, before we went online? Because online it says you're born in Australia.
No,
are you actually born in Czech Republic?
Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Czechoslovakia.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Going to Australia.
Look, I was born there just after the war. Dad had problems during the war because our country was occupied by the Nazis, and Dad had actually been arrested by the Gestapo. He was suspected of being involved in the underground movement, the resistance against the Nazis. He was also suspected of being involved with the wife of a high-ranking German officer. So he was hauled in for a not very gentle interrogation, and that was pretty heavy. And when and they finally released him. It left a lot of mental scars. And then after the war, the Russians came in. The Germans were defeated. But in a lot of ways, the Russians were worse than the Nazis because Dad was again arrested by the KGB. They perceived anybody who was an intellectual or a professional to be a threat to the regime. So Dad was hauled in for pretty brutal brutal interrogation by the KGB. Mm. And when they finally released him, Dad decided it was time for us to get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
So we hired people, smugglers, and they got us out, the whole family.
Because your dad was actually a lawyer as well,
yeah,
wasn't
he? Yeah, he was a lawyer.
Yeah, criminal lawyer?
He did a lot of everything, but criminal law was his main area, yeah. Yes.
And is that why you've, kind of that's your one of your legacies too, is it?
No, criminal lawyer. I was going to be a doctor initially, but for various reasons, I failed medicine and I switched over to law and became a criminal lawyer.
That was the reason? They're very different paths.
It's a different path. Can I just go back to the escape? Because this is quite interesting. When we left Czechoslovakia, we got people smugglers to smuggle us out. And it was pretty dangerous because people were getting shot trying to cross the border. It was the time of the Berlin Wall. People were getting killed crossing the Berlin Wall. The border was locked up, closed. That's what was called the Iron Curtain. So we hired people smugglers. Mum and Dad went first. That was the plan. They got across. Mum told me later that they were being smuggled across under a hay wagon through the border, through the checkpoint. They were hiding under a big pile of hay and manure on this wagon. And Mum also told me that when they went through one checkpoint, Russian border guards were prodding bayonets into the hay to see if there's escapees in there. And one of the bayonets missed Mum's face by mere centimetres. So they were lucky to get across. Then shortly after, when they got across to Austria, Vienna, they hired people smugglers to get me, my younger brother, grandmother and grandfather out. And I'll never forget that. We went across with a party of other refugees, about, I think, 20 people, with half a dozen people smugglers in charge of our party. And they were all very heavily armed because it was dangerous and people were getting killed. And I remember I was 5 years old. I'll never forget it. We were going across open fields, through forests, across streams, rivers, dirt roads. And one morning very early, we were spotted by a Russian border guard on a motorcycle. He'd been patrolling the area and he came riding over to where we were. And the leader of our party signaled us all to duck down in the grass to try and avoid detection. But it was too late. He'd already spotted us. So he came roaring over on the bike. And only metres from my face, the leader of our party pulled out his revolver, pointed it and shot him point blank in the face. I'll never forget that.
No, I think if you're 5 years old, that's not something you're going to
get rid of. You'll never forget that, no.
Absolutely.
That had an impact on my life. It made me realise how precious life is, how ephemeral it is, and how quickly and easily it can end.
Mm. So how old were you when you came to Australia?
We went to Austria first and we were there for a few months and I was still five when we came to Oz. So yeah. I was about roughly 5 years old.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Was there much assimilation for you and your family?
A lot of problems, mate. Very hard to make friends when you don't know the language.
Mm.
I was bullied at school. Dad, because he'd been a professional with a high, top-paying job as a lawyer, he was suddenly relegated to doing manual labour in a factory, which was pretty hard for him. So that had an impact on his mental state, his psychological well-being. He started drinking very heavily and he became a chronic alcoholic. And when he got drunk, which was very often, he'd beat the shit out of Mum. And he'd beat me, he beat my little brother. He even beat the family dog, which was a bit over the top. So this went on right up until while I was growing up. It was a pretty horrible way to grow up.
Yeah.
When I turned 15, I started lifting weights and I must have good genetics. I put on a lot of muscle very quickly and the next time he went to hit me, I knocked him out. the beautiful left hook. he was out cold before he hit the ground. And my happiest memory of the old man is seeing him lying on the kitchen floor out cold. Never hit anyone again after that.
Jesus, okay.
Did the abuse stop after that?
The violence certainly stopped. He never hit mum again or me or my little brother. Even left the dog alone. But his drinking got worse.
Yeah.
The drinking didn't stop.
And did you carry on at the gym?
Mate, that was a turning point in my life. It made me realise for the first time the awesome power of physical strength and physical fitness. And that has moulded and shaped my entire life ever since. I've never stopped weight training. I got into wrestling, martial arts, all sorts of physical activities. And that's never left me. It's shaped my whole life.
In what way?
In that showed me the importance of physical strength and physical fitness in dealing with things in life, your health, dealing with bullies, dealing with self-esteem issues. And I had massive self-esteem issues because of the way the old man treated me. He made me, I felt like I was a worthless piece of shit right up to the age of 15. And it wasn't until I knocked him out that I started rebuild or started to gain self-esteem and self-worth. And I think from that day on, I think looking back on my life, I think I've been attempting my whole life to prove to myself and to the whole world that I'm not a worthless piece of shit. Mm. And that's why I've done a lot of things that I've done in my life, motivated by that.
Mm. So you mentioned the physical strength is sort of pathed your way. Was that, sorry, taking it back to when you first started this podcast, you mentioned about saving a lawyer?
Oh, yeah. No, not a lawyer, a judge.
A judge.
Yes. Apologies. Yes. I got into wrestling when I went to Sydney Uni to do medicine. I met an amazing guy there named Richard Drake. He was the best wrestler in Australia. I think he'd gone to the Olympics as well. He not only taught me how to wrestle, he taught me how to fight. Never ever take a step back. And I did amateur wrestling for a number of years, quite successfully. I had aspirations to go to the Olympics, but I wasn't quite good enough, so that didn't happen. And then later on, I switched to pro. I did pro wrestling for a couple of years to make money to put myself through university. So pro wrestling was great fun. Loved it.
Did you have a wrestling name?
Yeah, Peter Wayne. I changed my surname to Wayne. At the suggestion of someone who said, look, you could pretend to be John Wayne's nephew.
Nice. I was going to go with Bruce Wayne from Batman, but
So I kept my Christian name, changed the surname. It was good fun.
And so that put you through your medical school, but then you went to your to the
well,
the
it helped, legal helped pay for the other studies too, because when I failed medicine, I bummed around a few years, did the wrestling, worked as a nightclub bouncer, gym instructor, professional lifeguard, and then came back to uni and did law.
Right. So what brought you back to uni? Just that wasn't sustainable?
Look, I did a lot of stuff. I did stunt work in movies. I did a bit of male modelling. And then
Modelling, that was last week, wasn't it?
And then I realised that I couldn't be a bum my whole life, so I decided to go back to uni and did law. Yeah, it was a good move.
I really
enjoy law. It's good fun.
What did you like about the criminal law side of things?
Oh, mate, criminal law, in my book, is the only area of law that's worth doing. The other stuff is all batshit boring.
Like
commercial law, civil law, conveyancing. No way, mate, I couldn't do that. I couldn't imagine doing anything other than criminal. I've done over 100 murder trials, prosecuting and defending, and they're a lot more fun than sitting in an office doing conveyancing.
Yeah. Right? So criminal law is like the ones that, I'm just going to sort of dramatise this, like that we see in the movies,
Yeah, that's
the one. You don't see conveyancing in the movies or anything else like that.
Conveyancing would not attract movies, I promise you.
I don't think so.
I think murder trials are top of the hit list,
So
everyone loves true crime.
So speaking from ignorance here, so if you have to represent someone who you know is guilty or something like that, how do you do that?
Okay. Yeah, it's funny, everyone asked me that question.
And I thought it was original.
It's a very good question, but it's often asked. And the simple short answer is you don't know that they're guilty. I mean, I might have a client come to me and tell me a story or a version of what happened, and I think, what a load of bullshit. It couldn't have happened that way. And then I find as the trial progresses, that's exactly what happened. Mm. You know, his version was completely true and correct. So I now do not try to second guess a client's instructions or versions. My job is to run his case according to his instructions that he's told me.
Yeah.
It's not my job to determine whether he's telling me the truth. That's the jury's job. The jury's got to decide whether his version is bullshit or whether they're satisfied that the prosecution has proved their case to beyond a reasonable doubt. That's not my job. My job is to give him the best possible defence based on his instructions to me. And at the end of the day, no one really knows where the truth lies. I don't really know. The jury doesn't really know. They base their verdict on all the evidence or lack of satisfaction of the evidence. The only people who really know what happened are the people who were there.
Mm. Yeah, that's fair. His, hers and the truth, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
Any more questions about criminal law, mate?
Oh, mate, they're stewing, mate. Don't worry. There's going to be a lot
more. So out of the 100 you've done, Pete,
yeah,
are there any that stick out?
Absolutely. We've just completed a podcast called The Lambo Lawyer. It's accessible on Spotify, Acast and Applecast. And I tell people that when you listen to our podcast, it'll make you laugh, it'll make you cry, and there are parts that will absolutely make you gasp. And I related this particular murder trial, which I defended in Hong Kong, and this will make people gasp. I was defending a Nigerian, ethnic Nigerian, who was a British citizen from London. He's an engineer working in Hong Kong. He was charged with murdering his Filipina girlfriend. They'd been in a relationship. She dumped him. He didn't enjoy being dumped. He wanted her back. She didn't want to be back. So he'd send her threatening messages on her phone, threatening to kill her. So obviously she was pretty rattled by all this. She went to the Filipino consulate to get protection, and they put her in a refuge for Filipino women who were being abused by their bosses and partners, and there are a lot of those. He found out where she was, and he barged in through the front door, past security guards, in front of witnesses. He beat the shit out of her, dragged her out of the building by the hair. She was semi-conscious, dragged around the side of the building, around to the back of the building, and there was a drain there, a drain for a sewerage. And he lifted the manhole cover off this sewerage container, and he stuffed her semi-conscious body headfirst into this sewerage container. She drowned in about 6 inches of sewerage at the bottom of this container. So it was a pretty horrific death.
Jesus.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, that one would stick out.
It stuck out all right, yeah. Mate. It's the worst case I ever did. He was a total asshole, this guy.
Mate, you've seen some pretty bad sides of society, huh?
Mate, I've seen the whole cross-section from the absolute worst to the absolute best and everything in between.
Does it change your perspective on reality?
No, not really. One of the things I learned when I first started practicing criminal law, and it was a very valuable lesson because a lot of barristers don't know how to do this. This guy who was my mentor, he taught me how to switch off my emotions. You have to be able to reach into your brain and find this particular switch that controls your emotions. You have to switch it off so that when you go into court, you're like a robot, an automaton. You have no fear. You've got no compassion. You feel nothing, absolute zero feelings, and you function like a robot, an automaton. And that's the only way you can survive this sort of environment. And a lot of barristers can't do that. And what they do, they self-medicate on drugs, cocaine, totally destroy their health. But the thing you have to remember when you finally come out of court, you got to learn to switch it back on again. Otherwise, your wife will divorce you.
Yeah, see, it'll be like method acting, you know, like once you find that switch.
You've got to find the switch.
Yeah,
without the switch, you've
got to flick it back on.
Guys cannot survive without finding that switch. I was very lucky. I was taught how to find it very early in life.
And how? How do you find that switch?
You put yourself into a sort of a, it's like a meditation, like a trance almost. Before I walk into court, I just sort of sit back, lean my head back, roll my eyes to the ceiling and just switch off and sort of self-hypnosis, so to speak, yeah.
So kind of getting in the zone if you're
getting in the zone. You've got to get in the zone.
Go up for a footy match or go...
If you're not in the zone, you're fucked. You can't do the job. Yeah, absolutely.
And did you learn some of those skills as well in your sports? You know, the kind of...
Absolutely. Visualization techniques. I used to win wrestling tournaments through visualizing. I would mentally visualize totally destroying my opponent and just wrecking him. And usually that's how it happened. Or when I was doing surf ski racing, I've paddled surf skis across tropical oceans.
Yeah, you've got a record for that.
Oh, yeah, we got a world record for paddling a surf ski across the South China Sea from Hong Kong to the Philippines.
Casual.
How long did that take?
4.5 days.
Fucking what?
We had a big backup support boat with this big 100-foot motor power boat, which was donated by a mate who was a Hong Kong billionaire. He let us have the boat free of charge and everything. We only had to pay for the petrol. He supplied everything else. But the way I got into that, the zone for that was, for weeks, I would be visualizing myself paddling onto the beach at the Philippines and kneeling down, kissing the ground.
Yeah.
That was a visual image I had. Yeah. Later on, I went to the World Champs in Florida in 2002, and I won a gold medal in the surf ski marathon and a bronze medal in the surf ski sprints. And what I did for months leading up to that, in addition to the very heavy training, I'd visualize myself standing on the podium, getting a gold medal put around my neck. And in this case, it was even better. I got a gold and a bronze. So visualization techniques are very useful.
Manifest the winner.
Manifest the win. Make it happen and that becomes reality.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Do you do that when you're racing around the track?
Me or him?
You.
I'm a team principal.
Yeah, but you still get a nudge around the circuit sometimes.
Oh, man, I'm a big visualizer as well. I always like to visualize my focus.
Yeah.
And it works. It does.
Yeah, okay.
I haven't gone across the South China Sea, but not yet anyway, you know.
Well, mate, that record still stands. No one's done it since.
Is that a challenge?
Take you out. Well, mate, the big we had some problems in that paddle. There were problems with sharks. Channel 7 did a documentary on it, and there's a great scene there where Danny Leung, the skipper of our support boat, standing on the bridge with a submachine gun, blasting away at a big tiger shark that had got too close to Billy Prestige, who was on the ski at that time. And you could see the water spouts kicking up as the bullets hit the water. And the next scene, you see all this pool of red blood as the shark's body sinking beneath the waves. That was pretty cool. But the biggest problem we had of all, and people are surprised by this, were not just jellyfish stings and heat exhaustion. One of the guys collapsed with heat exhaustion. We had to revive him with ice.
Oh, wow.
But the biggest problem we had of all was flying fish.
Really?
We had collisions with high-speed flying fish, especially at night. We had a big spotlight mounted on the bow of our support boat so that it would be shining on the water ahead of us so we could read the waves. The flying fish would be attracted by this light and then blinded by it. Crash, they'd come flying into our bodies.
Projectile.
At high speed. They were like Exocet missiles, I swear to God.
Kamikaze fish.
Our bodies were covered with bruises from collisions with high-speed flying fish. Billy Prestige got whacked in the forehead with one collision. He had blood streaming down his face and chest through the whole of his paddling shift. It was unreal. Yeah.
And so what took you to Hong Kong and why were you there for kind of 18 years?
Oh, okay, look, I'd gone through two marriages in Australia. I was constantly cheating on both my first two wives. It wasn't for me. I just left my second wife and I was getting bored in Sydney. And I had a couple of mates working in Hong Kong as Crown prosecutors. And I spoke to them and they said, look, mate, come on up. We'll get you an interview with the Attorney General. And with your experience in criminal law, you shouldn't have any trouble getting a job as a Crown prosecutor. So, yeah, I flew up. They got the interview, got the job. And initially I was just going to do a 2.5-year contract and then go back home, like a 2.5-year paid holiday. But then, wow, 18 years later, I'm still there. It's like being chained to golden handcuffs. You just couldn't tear myself away. It was so good.
Yeah.
So 8.5 years later, I'm still there.
Yeah, okay. And was it the kind of nature of the work over there? Was it the lifestyle?
No, it wasn't just the work. It was the work. I mean, I did some amazing cases that would absolutely blow your mind. People love true crime, and one of the things in our podcast we're talking about is true crime. But it wasn't just the cases I was doing, it was the lifestyle. It was a fantastic lifestyle. I met some of the most beautiful women on the planet. I met some of the most interesting people on the planet. And it was just such a great experience. And because Hong Kong, the way it's located geographically, it's right on top of the world, whereas Australia's right down the bottom, Hong Kong's in the middle. So it's easy to go anywhere. Yeah. We could hop on a plane, fly to Manila or Bangkok just for a weekend, or Vietnam. America's easy to get to. Yeah. England's easy to get to. South America, I've been to South America many times. So it's much easier to travel all around the world from Hong Kong than it is from Oz. Absolutely.
Any favourite parts of the world?
Brazil, Rio de Janeiro.
Why is that?
The best women on the planet. Rio de Janeiro's got it.
I had a feeling you were going to say that. Right.
The Rio women are unreal, absolutely unreal. And if the, I don't know if this is an R-rated show, but am I allowed to say why?
Yeah, anything goes.
Of course.
Okay, yeah, well, Rio women leave all other women for dead because they've only got three main interests in life. That's going to the soccer, watching soccer, going to the beach, Copacabana, Ipanema, and thirdly, they love fucking. And not necessarily in that order. So they're the three reasons.
Sounds like my spirit animal.
mate, every guy should go to Rio at least once before he dies and then he can die happy.
Yeah, yeah.
I swear to God.
So that's actually probably a nice segue because whilst you've been in the news for your Hollywood stuff, which we'll come back to, you were also in there earlier on for a number play.
Yeah,
the Transport New South Wales to court.
I did.
What was that all about?
Okay, well, look, I hadn't had the car that long and I was sitting around the coffee shop with some mates. We were trying to pick out some personalised number plates and initially we thought, Top Gun, Maverick, Iceman, that sort of bullshit, but that's all pretty lame. So one of the mates came out with the plate, what about LGOPNR? I said, what does that mean? He said, oh, leg opener. and I thought, oh, okay. And he said, mate, that'd be a great tribute to your reputation as a player. So I thought, yeah, okay, let's go with that. But you know what? The main reason we picked those plates was to take the piss and stick it to the PC mob, the woke weirdos, the crazy Karens and the stupid snowflakes. That's the main reason we picked those plates, to take the piss out of them.
I mean, you could feel you don't necessarily get leg opener from those letters until you say it, in all fairness.
Well, mate,
I thought it was Lego.
Well, the thing is, I had them for a whole year without any complaints. And what's ironic about this, guys, is that I was getting ready to put on new plates and I was about to change them when I got this very rude, arrogant letter from the government telling me that I've got to hand the plates back. They're deemed to be offensive. So, mate, the surest way to make me do something in life is to tell me I can't do it, I'm not allowed to do it. So I said, well, fuck you, I'll see you in court. So I took the government to court. We had a long, lengthy legal battle that went for almost 2 years. And when the story broke in the media, it just went ballistic. The story was picked up all over the world. Every news outlet in the world picked it up. And my mates who do this sort of stuff electronically told us that we even knocked Donald Trump off number one position for 3 days on international Google.
No way.
We did, and it was a great story. And not long after that, I got a good mate, Bobby Coggle, who's now my agent, PR manager. Turns out a Hollywood film production company now wants to make a movie about my life because of all this publicity that came out because of the plates. So he's now in talks with these people in LA. They're coming up actually in a couple of weeks. And he's in talks with a guy in Sydney who's talking about doing a Netflix TV series. So whoever complained about those plates did me a huge favour.
You should send them a bunch of flowers.
I should send them champagne and several bunch of flowers. Yeah, I don't know who it was, and I don't give a fuck actually, but it certainly panned out well for us.
So I've always wanted to know this, right? So you represented yourself?
No.
Oh, okay, because I was always wondering.
You never, ever represent yourself.
No, why is that?
We got an old saying in the legal profession. Anyone who represents himself in court has got a fool for a client. And that's true. The reason is you're too close to it emotionally.
Yeah.
So I got two good mates to represent me, a senior QC and a junior barrister. And they went to court for me, and they did the battle, and cost me a tremendous... Guess how much it cost me? Fuck all.
I was wondering. It was like, surely it would have cost them a lot of money.
Nah, they did it for love, labour of love. And Sasha loved the publicity. He's a playboy too and a Casanova, and he loved being on TV. He was interviewed on Current Affair when this story came out, yeah.
So what did the letter look like? Did it say that it was leg opener? Or
no,
just
no,
no,
it was just oh, the letter just said, look, someone, the department has deemed that your plates could be considered to be offensive, but the idiot that wrote the first letter wrote it under the wrong legislation. No longer exists. It had been repealed.
Oh, my God.
So we went to court. The first time we went to court was Fairfield Court. The magistrate threw it out because the idiot had written the letter under the wrong legislation. So then I thought, okay, this may be the end of it. And the story broke. And I think the government was losing face. Yeah. So to save face, they decided to bat on. And I said, I was interviewed by Frank Chung on news.com.au and I think even TV. And I said, okay, if they want to bat on, bring it on. I'll give them a fucking war they will not believe. And that's exactly what happened. We gave them a war they will never forget.
That's brilliant. You're like the people's poet.
Yeah, mate, I love sticking it to the government and to PC idiots. And what this was all about was a couple of overzealous fat cat bureaucrats sitting behind their desks trying to flex their puny little muscles. Yeah. They picked the wrong guy to fuck with. Yeah. That's the bottom line.
Exactly right.
When I described you, and that was a quote, by the way, the way I described you, because it was as a narcissistic egomaniac, which is a quote from you.
Well, mate, I can...
Where does that come from?
Well, I can live with that. I was interviewed... I went on a show called Insight on the SBS channel, and this lady rang me a couple of weeks earlier and said, look, this was after all the publicity, and... the media had already labelled me a narcissist because of the plates. And she called me on the phone. She said, look, we want to invite you to come on one of our episodes. Would you be interested? And I said, well, look, it depends. What's the episode about? And she said, oh, narcissism. And I thought, okay, well, why did you pick me for an episode on narcissism? And she said, oh, that's easy. We Googled the word on the internet and your name and image came up all over the place.
You're kidding me.
No, dead set.
Fuck off.
So I went on the show and we had a lot of fun. And the reason I went on the show again was to take the piss and stick it to the PC mob, the woke weirdos and the Karens and the snowflakes.
Yeah.
And it worked. And you know why this story has struck such a chord with so many people? I'll tell you why. When the story first broke, I was down the South Coast visiting some friends with the Lamborghini. And people would see the plates, they'd see the car, they've seen the story on the media, they'd approach me, strangers, and want to shake my hand for standing up for, you know, against censorship, for freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and getting into the government.
Yeah.
So I was congratulated and had my hand shaken. When I drove into Sydney the next day, cars who recognised the plates and the car were honking their horns and pumping their fists in the air.
Absolutely.
One truck driver nearly crashed his truck. he was coming the opposite way. He saw my car and he came to a screeching halt, nearly crashed into the car in front of him, and he leans out the window and he's screaming at me, "You're a fucking legend, mate. I heard you're
Australian.
I heard your interview with Cole and Jackie O. Good on you, mate. You're a fucking legend." But I'll tell you the reason why people love this stuff, because I think people, not just in Australia, little Aussie battlers, but all over the world, they're getting sick and tired of being bullied by governments. Look what's happening in Iran and China. There's massive protests against government bullies. They're sick and tired of being dictated to by these shrieking minorities, these woke weirdos and these PC idiots who are trying to dictate to us what we can and can't say, what we can and can't do, and even what we can and can't think. People are thinking, well, fuck you, we don't want to take this anymore. And the silent majority, unfortunately, they don't like it, but they don't do anything about it. And when someone stands up and sticks it to these assholes, everyone claps and cheers. That's why the stories, mate, got so much traction.
Well, people don't get up and say anything because they're scared of getting cancelled.
They're scared of getting cancelled by cancel culture. Mm. Now, I don't give a fuck about cancel culture because I've got money. And one of the beautiful things about having money, apart from buying big boys' toys that we race with, money to me is important because it gives you the power and the ability to say fuck you to just about everyone and anyone. Mm. I call it fuck you money. Mm. And that's why I couldn't give a rat's ass about cancel culture. But most people are scared of it because they might lose their job or they might lose their income or they might get sacked from university or some crap like that. You enjoying this so far?
Absolutely. It's a very refreshing way of looking at it. I mean, I'm a big fan of stand-up comedy and you know, a lot of the comedians will talk about the cancel culture now and you almost get a sense that
they're scared.
Their material,
They've got the sense of their material.
Of being censored. Yeah. So I went to see Chris Rock actually back in August. He was here in Sydney and everyone had to put their phone in a locked bag.
Okay, yeah.
So, and it was one of the best experiences because not only, no one was taking photos, but no one was recording. So he was...
Can't take it out of context.
Yeah, you sense this kind of freedom in his material and his storytelling and his jokes, and some of them were a little bit risky, but that's how comedians learn about the material, is by pushing the envelope and pushing back.
Some of the funniest comedians were people like Benny Hill.
Yeah,
Richard Pryor.
Richard Pryor and a smutty, dirty comedy, and that was the funniest. Mm-hmm. Now it's not allowed anymore. Mm. The comedians are so shit scared of being cancelled, they self-censor everything they come up with. It's sad, very sad.
Yeah.
So what's your thoughts on Elon Musk getting Twitter?
I think it's great. Mm. Elon Musk has decided, fuck censorship. I'm all for freedom of speech, and I'm a big freedom of speech fan. I'm totally against censorship. So three cheers for Elon Musk.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I agree. Like, freedom of speech should be a thing, Yeah, there can be consequences for your words. Yeah, of course, but that's part of the joy of freedom of speech. You're allowed to say what you want. Doesn't mean it doesn't come without consequence.
But hang on, mate. I think freedom of speech also involves the freedom to offend.
Yeah, of course.
People forget that. Now, often people who are offended by freedom of speech, or people who are offended by my number plate, they choose to be offended. Yeah. It's not my problem. It's their problem. And I was once asked by one of the journalists who did this story with me. She said, "Well, what do you say to people who are offended by your number plates?" I said, "Tough shit. Mm. Get a life. Get over it. Get a sense of humour."
Mm.
That's my attitude to it.
It's true.
You're allowed to offend people. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, exactly. It's also subjective as well.
Yeah.
What's your plate now?
Okay. XXLEGO.
Nice.
Double XL, that's the size of my T-shirts, Pete.
Extra large ego.
Yeah, very good. Very good. So tell me about this movie stuff, because you were just in something called Crazy Love.
We did a movie last year. Excuse me. Yep. I was scouted in a KFC restaurant in Gosford.
Popular spot.
Yeah. I was visiting some friends on the Central Coast and I stopped there to have lunch.
What's your poison there? Three-piece or are you more of a zinger?
Mate, normally I don't eat that shit, but I was in a hurry. So I parked the Lambo outside. I'm eating a KFC chicken leg or something. And these two girls came into the restaurant and they were very excited and agitated. They'd seen my car outside and the girl says, "Is that yours?" I said, "Yeah." "Oh, wow, wow." And then she started chatting to me and was Karina Lee. She was the producer and director of this gangster movie and a girlfriend was with her. And Karina, seeing me in the restaurant, decided I was finger-licking good. So, so she said to me,
great.
She said, "Mate, you would make a terrific gangster in our movie." And I said, "Well, I've had a bit of experience with gangsters. I deal with them almost every day in my job." And then she said, "Look, we're doing this movie, starts on such and such a date. Would you be interested in being in the movie?" And I said, "Well, what part do you want me to play?" So I was going to play a muscle-bound gangster named Seal who carried a gun. And so I said, "Yeah, okay." I was available and free, so I said, "Yeah, I'll do it." So we did the film up on West Gosford in a warehouse, which they had rented very cheaply. And she had a lot of people there who were friends. She's done movies before. They had all the crew, the sound, the lighting, everything. And she'd recruited a number of other actors. And I was playing this muscle-bound gangster named Seal. I had a gun. We had a number of hostages tied up in this warehouse to chairs, and they were gagged and hooded, and we're holding them hostage for ransom. And the cops eventually raided the place, and me and Karina, who was the leading lady as well as the producer and director, hopped in the Lambo, and we accelerated up the hill at supersonic speed with the cops chasing us. So it was good fun. It was a good fun movie.
So your car's in the movie as well?
Yeah, absolutely. The car's in it as well.
And what's the movie called?
Crazy Love.
Yeah, nice.
They're going to enter it in Tropfest, I think.
Nice.
And we had a premiere for it last December at Long Bay at Toto's Bar, and it was sold out premiere. We got a standing ovation. It was terrific. Yeah, I loved it. The media were all over it. That we got some great publicity. These days, it seems that with the media, all I have to do is sneeze and the media's all over it, like a rash. It's great.
Yeah. And so speaking of media, you mentioned your podcast, The Lambo Lawyer.
Yep.
What's the content there?
Okay. The Lambo Lawyer was a concept that was born many years ago. I've been hassled by people and friends for years and years to sit down and write a book about some of my experiences and things I've done. And I've always not had the time or the inclination. Something's always intervened. Big court case, training, sport, social life.
Yeah.
So it never really happened. So when all this stuff came out about the number plates and the publicity there and the interest of Hollywood, my mate Bobby Coggill, who I've known since we're 18, he's a brilliant guy. He's an accountant. He's also a networker. This guy knows everyone in the world. If there's someone Bobby doesn't know, they're not worth knowing. He's also a great marketer. So Bobby jumped on this and he ran with it. So we organised the podcast in January with Podshape, a brilliant guy named Jay Walkerden. He's the producer and the narrator. He kicked it off with us last January. It's been running now. We've been working on it for 12 months. It was finally released. And wow, it's only been out a couple of weeks. And we were informed by the executives that it's jumped to the top of the charts. It's with Spotify, it's number 10. On Apple Podcast, it's now number 1.
Nice.
And it's in the last week alone, it's grown 89%. So the distributors are over the moon. They think it's great, yeah. But basically what the podcast is all about, it essentially covers my whole life.
Yeah.
The first episode is what I told you guys about our escape and dealing with Dad's alcoholism. Then it progresses through, and there's three main purposes of the podcast. Mm. Number one, It's to give hope and inspiration to cancer sufferers, people who are now going through the shit that I went through 15 years ago. I beat lung cancer 15 years ago. I was training for a surf ski race in Hawaii. It was the world champs race from Molokai to Oahu. I'd been training for a whole year on the ski. And one week I'm trying to figure out how much water to carry on my ski to get me from Molokai to Oahu. The second week I'm on the operating table fighting for my life. And the surgeons had to rip out the whole top third of my right lung. Now, not only did that save my life, but it completely cured me. And I've now been 15 years all clear, PET scans every year, completely clear. So what we want to do with this podcast, because one of the things I'm doing is I mentor and counsel cancer sufferers, people who are going through the shit that I went through 15 years ago. One of the biggest problems with a cancer sufferer, and I had this, there's no one to talk to. You can't talk to your wife, your husband, your loved ones or your mates. And you know why? Because they don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Mm. It's only, they can only talk to someone who's been there, done that. And talking to someone who's been there, done that makes it a hell of a lot easier. That's what I missed when I was going through my battle. What got me through 15 years ago, I read a book by Lance Armstrong called It's Not About the Bike. It was documenting his battle with very serious cancers, overcoming them, beating them, and coming back to win the Tour de France 7 times. To me, that was the ultimate comeback story of all time. And I thought that was great. I read the book 7 times. That helped me get through my battle. But guys who are going through this shit now, I help them enormously just by sitting down talking to them. So that's the number one reason for the podcast. Number two, in episode 5, it deals with a little girl named Eden Westbrook who was found hanging from a tree at the age of 15. And we're trying to get justice for her family. Of course, the cops totally fucked it up. They totally fucked up the death scene. They left this little child's body hanging in the tree for several hours, exposed to gawking passerbys who were filming them with their mobile phones, exposed to school kids going past in school buses. The cops made no attempt to cut her down or cover her. When Mum and Dad arrived at the scene, this fucking idiot cop is questioning Dad in front of his dead child's body swinging from the tree. I could not believe the insensitivity and stupidity of these dumb fuck cops. I just couldn't believe it. Then it got worse. The investigation was totally bungled. They failed to interview crucially important witnesses, either failed to or refused to. CCTV footage of this young girl talking to an older woman, appearing to be in a heated argument, that footage disappeared. Now that's bullshit. Footage doesn't disappear. It's made. I'm working with a guy in Tassie at the moment. He's a QC named Greg Richardson. He's a Top Gun fighter in Tasmania. We're going to try and go to the Supreme Court and get the Supreme Court to order the coroner to reopen the inquest and have a proper inquest. So that's the second reason we're doing this podcast, to get justice for Eden's family. The third reason is I've got a little grandchild who's nearly 3, granddaughter. I've never met her. I probably never will. Me and my son have been estranged for several years because his wife doesn't like me, and she's persuaded him to turn his back on me and my whole family. So I've never met my grandchild. So this podcast, when she's old enough to listen to it, and any movie that we make will help her to see that I left a few footprints on this planet so that she would be proud of me. So they're the three reasons for our podcast.
Wow. That's three very, very powerful reasons.
Thanks, mate.
Absolutely. So much to unpack there.
Yeah.
They've refused so far. The chief coroner has refused for reasons known only to the chief coroner. Yes. We're now going to try and go to the Supreme Court.
Doesn't that ring alarm
bells? Oh, of course it rings alarm bells, mate. The whole thing's... There's something rotten in the state of Tasmania, put it that way. I don't want to go any. Can only do that if we can persuade the Supreme Court to order the coroner or order the magistrate to hold a new inquest. That's our number one goal at this point. And we're hoping the pressure with the podcast from Hobart, pressure from me and our podcast, pressure from the media and the Supreme Court ultimately will reach that goal and get a second coroner's inquest, a proper coroner's inquest, not this Mickey Mouse bullshit behind closed doors, but a proper coroner's inquest where we can ventilate everything that happened and get justice for Eden's family.
If there is an inquest, or if there is a certain way an inquest is supposed to be done, why wasn't it followed?
Well, mate, ask the authorities in Tasmania. I don't know. Their system is so Mickey Mouse. I've never heard of a coroner's inquest where you simply read statements behind closed doors without allowing any testing of the evidence and then rubber stamping it that it's suicide. That's not justice. That's bullshit. That's not a coroner's inquest. That's a farce.
Yeah.
So am I right in thinking, I mean, you clearly... Are you still practicing law? Or are you still across everything?
Well, mate, people ask me that, and I'll tell you the same thing. I'm a gym junkie full time. I pump iron in the gym every day. I'm a race car driver full time, and I practice law part time in my spare time. I don't want to upset that balance in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, okay.
I still do a bit. I did a big rape trial last year, which we won. Yeah. Yes. So yeah, I still do a bit.
So what's the future for you?
Oh, the future is, I mean, okay.
If there's a bucket list, you've ticked a lot of things off it.
Yeah, there's still a lot to go.
Nice.
One, so we want justice for Eden's family. Yep. That's number one. Number two, we'd like to give hope and inspiration to cancer sufferers. I want to do more work in that area.
Because you actually didn't smoke, did you?
Never
you,
smoked,
you had lung
no.
cancer, but you've never
I got it from neighbours who were chain smokers in the flat below us.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I never smoked in my life. Yeah. So we want to do something with cancer sufferers. I mentor and counsel cancer sufferers. And basically, I would like someday maybe to be reunited with my grandchild.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's the future.
Yeah.
And a Hollywood movie and a Netflix TV series would be nice.
Oh, in Brazil.
I don't think my present wife would let me go back there. No.
Yeah. So your marital status, you are married?
I've been married three times. I constantly cheated on both my first two wives. Wasn't their fault, it was my fault. They were both good women. Mm. They didn't deserve to have that shit inflicted on them. But I'm now married to my third beautiful wife, who's not only my wife, she's my best friend, my soulmate, and she's terrific. She's great.
Awesome.
And how long have you been together?
We've been married now for 16 years.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Congratulations.
She's a good woman.
Excellent. Excellent. Is there anything you do differently, Peter, looking back?
Looking back on my life? Yeah, I'd go downstairs and kick the shit out of my neighbours who gave me lung cancer. Mm. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And the reason I didn't then, I was worried about police prosecution. That's the only thing that stopped me. Mm. And getting the ticket punched as a barrister, because if you got a conviction for assault, they won't let you practice anymore. But yeah, I would have done that for sure.
Mm. Awesome. Well, mate, I think we're going to wrap it up.
All right, good.
Thank you very much for sharing.
It's been a great pleasure.
All of your stories.
It's been amazing.
Well, mate, that's not all of them. No, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
I know, right? I feel like we should get you back on.
Mate, listen to our podcast.
Yeah, we'll do.
It'll make you gasp.
We'll leave the links for your podcast as well in our description.
Beautiful. Thanks. Absolutely.
Mate, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers, Peter.
Thank you.
Cheers.